All right, everyone, if I could get your attention. Welcome to the 2014 convention edition of the ACB Legislative Seminar. My name is Eric Bridges. Thanks. I feel like we're at that point in the day where people are kind of like, yeah, sure, awesome. Just a good place to sit down for a while. So hopefully we can entertain you. We'll see. Got some dancing girls and jugglers. They're going to come in later. They're going to work together, which is going to be crazy. But in all seriousness, a lot has taken place since we last met in D.C. for the legislative seminar back in February. And we're going to go through some updates on the legislative end of what we work on as an organization, as well as some other legal advocacy that has taken place, which I'm sure many of you are aware of. So that's sort of the deal. We've got, I want to leave time at the end for questions. We're excited to have you all here. Why don't we kick this puppy off by going around and seeing who all is here. And by the way, thanks to Bruce Radke, the superstar volunteer, for assisting us. Oh, yeah. If there are folks in the room that want water and don't have it, please raise your hand. They will come and give you water. All right. Okay. Bruce, if you wouldn't mind being our roving mic guy and introducing ready. Folks.
Oh, just introducing people.
Yeah. You get to be talk show host guy in the audience.
Is it on? Yeah, it is. This is Jim Swartz from The Last Frontier, Alaska.
I'm Sandy Edwards, Arkansas.
Tony Stevens with National Interest for the Blind in Washington.
And an ACB member.
Aloha, Londa Falon from the state of Hawaii.
Art Cabanella, ACB member of Hawaii Association of the Blind.
And I'm Jim McIntosh from Seattle.
Susan Bowes, Silver Spring, Maryland.
Dan Dillon, President, Tennessee Council of the Blind.
Doug Powell, Falls Church, Virginia.
All right. Rick Triano, Boynton Beach, Florida.
Elaine Boykin, President of the Oklahoma Council of the Blind.
Jay Dowden, Oklahoma City.
Peggy Smith, United Workers for the Blind, St. Louis, Missouri.
Janet Day, Norfolk, Virginia.
P. Peter Link, Denver, Colorado.
Susan Thompson, Sydney, Australia.
George Abbott, Maryland.
Fred Scheiger, New York.
Ann Byington, Topeka, Kansas.
Michael Byington, all over Kansas.
Ivy from China, Macau.
Welcome.
Nigel Reichards, Florida Council of the Blind.
Teresa Curry, Gonzales, Louisiana.
David Lepofsky, Toronto, Canada, and the person who's going to put you to sleep during the banquet on Friday night.
Kathy Brockman, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Alice McGrath, California Council of the Blind.
Alan Peterson, North Dakota Association of the Blind, ACB board member, and hope to be after the convention.
Zelda Gebhardt, North Dakota Association of the Blind, Vice President.
Donna Hepper, North Dakota Association of the Blind, Board of Directors.
Scott Johnson, I'm from Elk Mound, Wisconsin.
Brenda Johnson, Elk Mound, Wisconsin.
All right, the Midwest representing.
Anna Lee Hathaway, Secretary, Utah Council of the Blind.
Anna Jeffrey, President, Utah Council of the Blind.
Pat Sheehan, Silver Spring, Maryland.
George Holliday, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Carol Ewing, Vice President of the Nevada Council of the Blind and co-chair of the host committee, and I hope you guys are having a great time.
It's been awesome. Okay. Thanks, Bruce. Good crowd from all over the world. Pretty cool. Well, we've got several issues that we are continuing to deal with. Just to sort of tick off some of them here. We've got the CRPD. We've got the Workforce Opportunity Investment Act. We've got a lawsuit that we filed. We've got two pieces of legislation that the blind community cares very deeply about. One dealing with the coverage or seeking to have Medicare cover low vision devices, and the other one dealing with special education legislation for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade. That's a little sampling of what we're going to cover today, and there may be one or two other items thrown into the mix as well. So that's sort of where we are. Not many of these issues are brand new to all of you, and many of you are grizzled veterans, as it were, with regard to policy and lobbying and advocating on Capitol Hill, and that's awesome. So we'll cover the waterfront again today, and towards the end we'll do Q&A, and we'll rock it out into Thursday evening. So what I thought we would do is start off by talking about a couple of initiatives that ACB has been dealing with. One in particular that ACB has been very active in over the last 5 years or so. And then the other one is the newest one, the newest issue. So you don't have to get bored by listening to me the whole time. My boss has graciously accepted my invitation to come and speak with you about the Marrakesh Treaty, which has been commonly known as the Treaty for the Visually Impaired, which last year, right before this convention was made a real treaty in Marrakesh, Morocco. Then the other issue that she's going to talk with you a little bit about is how we sue the government and how much fun that is. So, no, actually, the law, the class action lawsuit that we brought against the General Services Administration back in April 22nd, and a little bit about the some of the background behind that and the technological issues that unfortunately we as a community still face when attempting to interface with the federal government. So with that, I would like to invite our executive director, Melanie Brunson, to come and chat with you about these issues. Melanie.
When Eric asked me to talk about these issues, he didn't tell me that I had to entertain. I won't repeat that into the recording. If you want to talk, you can talk about the issues. So, let me see. Well, how does one talk about a treaty in an entertaining manner? Well, I'll let you know if I figure out the answer. But last year, as Eric said, when we came to convention, I had just been in Marrakesh, Morocco. And we had a really exciting time because when I left, there were people who didn't think it was going to happen. But when I came back from Marrakesh, we had a text that was developed to constitute a treaty for the improvement of access to printed materials for people who are blind, visually impaired, or have other print reading disabilities. It is a treaty that was put together by the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights, which is part of the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is part of the United Nations. I suppose I should have told you this could be a quiz afterward. So, basically, what this treaty does is any country that signs it agrees that they will ensure that their copyright law allows authorized organizations or authorized entities to either import or export books for the use of people with visual impairments or other print reading disabilities, and they can do so without permission from the copyright holder. The practical piece of this is that essentially, you all know how the National Library Service works in this country? This treaty is essentially having other countries pretty much do the same thing that our country does. That's the non-legalese explanation of what the Marrakesh Treaty does. The other piece of it, though, is that they have the ability to share books with people in other countries who are blind or visually impaired, or to import books from other countries for use of people in their own country who have visual impairments. And it's a really cool thing because for us in the United States, we have a pretty good system in place. But the problem is that if the United States has to produce a book then Canada produces the same copy, and the UK produces the same book, and Australia produces it, and New Zealand produces it. All of a sudden, there's half a dozen versions, all in English. So we waste resources when everybody's producing a copy of the same book because nobody can share it outside their country. Where if NLS produced a book and was able to share it with the libraries or the other nonprofit agencies in all of the other English-speaking countries, they'd have money freed up to do other books, which they could then share with us instead of everybody having to duplicate. So we are very hopeful that as this treaty becomes effective, it will enable us to have access to more books because it will free up resources worldwide. The other thing it will do for us in the United States is that it will give us access to foreign language books so that people for whom English is not their first language, as well as people who are studying foreign languages in this country, will have access to books in greater numbers and have something to read in the language that they speak or the language they're trying to learn. So it's a win-win. Just a couple of weeks, before I say that, the United States and most of the countries worldwide apparently have a similar process. Once the treaty is approved, then the diplomats sign it. But that's sort of a formality, because then what has to happen in virtually every country, apparently, is that some other body has to ratify that signature before it can actually become effective in that country. And as many of you know, in this country, the signature on treaties has to be ratified by the United States Senate. So we are awaiting the opportunity to bring the Marrakesh Treaty before the United States Senate. That has not happened yet because we've been waiting for the ratification vote on the Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities so that the senators don't get two disability-related treaties before them at once. I will refrain from making any comments as to why we can't do both of them at once, but we have decided not to at this point. And so we haven't, although we have started talking to staffers behind the scenes and trying to pave the way for a vote on it fairly quickly once we bring it to them, but we have not actually asked them to calendar it yet. One country has completed its ratification process and is now a full signatory, and that is India, as of, I think, the end of May. And I understand that that's a record, that many, many treaties don't get anybody to fully ratify it during their first year. The treaty takes 20 countries to ratify it before it becomes effective worldwide. So you will be hearing about that for a while, but it's a very promising development for us. And for the folks from around the world who have visual impairments. I want to turn now to the other issue that Eric asked me to address. It is an issue that has purely domestic ramifications. It is, and it's not legislative, but we think that you will all be very interested in it, because it is a lawsuit against the United States government, specifically the General Services Administration. We have, for many years in ACB, been interested in a little thing called Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, which essentially requires that federal agencies buy IT equipment and use software that is accessible and make their websites accessible. Well, many and most of that procurement, particularly of hardware and software within the United States government, is overseen by the General Services Administration. The General Services Administration also operates a website that anybody who gets federal grant money or anybody who is a federal contractor and wants to be paid for their services has to sign up. They have to register, I believe it's every 2 years. Well, guess what? That website is not 508 compliant, and it's not usable by people who use screen readers. The several individuals who were federal contractors alerted, and also ACB members, alerted us to the fact that they were having issues with that website. They also alerted the General Services Administration. And the General Services Administration basically said, well, that's kind of too bad. They basically said, we can solve a few of your problems, but we're not going to solve all of your problems anytime soon. And we can't help you with your registration. Well, if your livelihood depends on getting federal money, that's kind of a big problem. So we contacted a group in the Washington, D.C. area called the Washington Committee, Washington Lawyers Committee for Human and Civil Rights. Goodness gracious, you can tell it's getting late in the day. They connected us with a law firm, a very reputable and very capable law firm in the D.C. area. And between the two of them, we had consultation and decided to file a class action on behalf of all federal contractors and grantees who are blind. We have filed that lawsuit against the General Services Administration. Alleging that their website is not compliant. Interestingly enough, we did it with Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act because of the civil rights. I mean, you're talking about denying somebody their livelihood here, folks. So we, and it is also failure to provide access to a federal program, service, or activity. So we have done it under Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which is, by the way, the same section of the law that was the basis for our previous lawsuits against the Social Security Administration and the U.S. Department of the Treasury. So we are we're going to be at this for a while, that wouldn't you know it, and we weren't surprised, because I think it happened in both of the other cases too. The GSA has asked for, they're supposed to file an answer within 60 days of our filing of our complaint. They have asked for an extension. They have now till August. We did agree to it. They have till August to file their answer, so it'll be interesting to see what that answer is. But we will keep you posted as this develops, because it will have ramifications for other agencies of the federal government as well. So wanted to bring you all up to date on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Melanie. Well, during her presentation, we received a special delivery. It wasn't the dancing girls.
or men the experience.
But one of the issues that we have been talking about now for the better part of, I guess a couple years, is special education legislation that ultimately was introduced earlier this year and currently has about 20 co-sponsors, which is really good progress for it having only been introduced in literally just days before our legislative seminar took place. H.R. 4040, the Alice Cogswell and Ann Sullivan Macy Act. And what does it do? What does it seek to do for the education system as it pertains to blind kids who are kindergarten through 12th grade? What does it seek to do for kids who are deaf and hard of hearing? Because that's the other component of this. We are collaborating as a community with the deaf and hard of hearing community. We find that we have many of the same issues. We collaborated very successfully with regard to the CVAA, the 21st Century Communications and Video Accessibility Act. The author of this piece of legislation, H.R. 4040, is here with us to pride himself away from a blackjack table and is going to chat with you a little bit more about it. He's pretty busy guy, and it's good that he's taken a little bit of time to spend it with us this afternoon. But this bill is something that ACB, along with the American Foundation for the Blind and other blindness organizations, are actively advocating for, and it's getting a lot of visibility. Back in May, we did a briefing to Congress on this bill. About 30 staffers from the House and the Senate showed up to listen to what it was we had to say. My colleague Mark, who's next to me here, Mark Reichert, and I, and two representatives from the deaf community, spent an hour briefing folks. It was a really good turnout for an issue like this that's just sort of gaining some momentum and some visibility on Capitol Hill. So I will not take up any more time, but rather introduce you to the Director of Public Policy at the American Foundation for the Blind, our colleague and friend and lifetime ACB member, Mark Reichert.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you're doing well. I was just saying to Eric, boy, anybody who has to listen to me at, hold on, wait, 4:45. Oh, that's terrible. You poor people. 4:45 on a Wednesday. Wow. I should be handing out some of these chips that I won at the, they're only 50 cent chips though. So don't get too excited. So let me ask you a couple questions, and I want you to shout back out to me, because, I mean, the idea that you people only get to, you know, just sit there and listen just frankly appalls me. All right? You need to be able to participate. So are blind kids in this country getting the Braille instruction that they deserve?
No.
Yeah, you sure about that?
Yes.
Yeah? So don't everybody talk at once, but which one of you out there, just start shouting. How do you know that? How do you know blind kids aren't getting the instruction that they should be getting in terms of Braille? because I told you. You know what's cool about that? You're my new best friend, man. That's awesome. He says, because I told you. We were joking around in the resolutions committee last night, I think it was. It feels like about 4 years ago. People have a tendency to believe whatever they read. So I was saying to them, yeah, you know, that should be our new motto in resolutions. I wrote it down, and then I read it. I believe everything that I read, right? Because you believe your own stuff after a while. But you're absolutely right. Blind kids aren't getting it, getting the Braille instruction that they need. And we know it because parents tell us that. We know teachers of blind kids tell us that. We know because more blind kids that are going off to college and if post-college or if they don't go to college but they're going off doing other things, they don't know Braille. They just don't know it. And so, we've got to change that. Let me ask you, are blind kids getting the orientation and mobility instruction that all of them need? They're not. They're not. How do you know that other than the fact that I just told you? Yeah. Because you see them. There may be one or two of those people here at this convention. Hopefully it wasn't me that ran into you so I can demonstrate my O&M lack of competence, I guess. But you're absolutely right. Blind kids aren't getting the O&M instruction, at least the full orientation mobility instruction that they need. Let me ask you this. How many kids with low vision are getting the assistive technology that they're supposed to get? See, I played a trick on you. You got used to saying no, 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 and then I just ask you an open-ended question. You can't handle it. See, this is the problem with... But not enough. Well, that's okay. That's a good answer. You're right about that. And why do you suppose that is? Well, I mean, there's a whole host of reasons for that. I mean, on the one hand, you got blind kids, barely able to squint at much of anything, and they really should be getting Braille instruction, and yet people say, well, you know, let's make this kiddo use as much of his or her vision as maybe left, even though what he's got or she's got is virtually nothing, which is totally in violation of the law. But nevertheless, it's the kind of thing that, kids with low vision aren't getting. Even if they're forced to be denied Braille instruction, they're certainly not given the full array of gizmos that they could use. They're not properly evaluated by low vision specialists at all. And so it's a real problem. How many blind kids go off to college or get out of high school? Maybe they go on to do other things besides college. But how many of them do you think are able to successfully live on their own these days and manage their affairs on their own? Not as many as there should be. I mean, a lot of folks are here. A lot of us, I would suspect probably all of us in this room, I would hope, got to this joint by ourselves to one degree or another. And we managed to manage our affairs just fine. Yet there's a lot of blind kids out there, and we all, I think, probably know personal examples of this, where, you know, the kid might be incredibly bright, might be a total genius when it comes to math and science and those wonderful so-called STEM subject areas, science, technology, engineering, and math areas. But do you think they know how to make a bed? Do you think they know how to cope with living on their own once they go off to college? Not so much. There are all kinds of horrible... They're not hypotheticals, but would it be horror stories about kids who are these academic whiz kids, and frankly, they go off to some fancy school, and they just can't seem to make it on their own. And you know, we've all been there if we've done college, or frankly, just leaving home for the first time. I mean, everybody, it's a tough time for everybody who goes through that experience. But if you're a blind kid and you haven't been given the training that you need to be able to live independently and do those kinds of socialization, have those social integration skills that you need, the independent living skills that you need, that fear of being away from home and the challenges that come naturally from becoming a grown-up are just that much more exacerbated. I was about to say exasperated. They're probably exasperated, too. They're both exacerbated and exasperated. Try that at 5 o'clock. Say that. So... How do we go about changing all of that? I mean, one of the reasons why both you and I cannot answer the question about how many blind kids across the country are learning Braille. I mean, we know that anecdotally, but we don't know it in a factual, scientific sort of way. We can't necessarily put numbers on it. Some people have done some decent research on this question, but there's no real sort of authoritative, nationally recognized thing about Braille. In spite of the fact that the laws for almost, 17 years now, a little bit, thereabouts, has basically said, you know what, Braille is absolutely required, and it's the default position, and the only way that you get out of providing Braille is if most everybody's sitting around the table deciding on this kid's future, including the kid, him or herself, who does have a right to be at the IEP table. If most everybody agrees that Braille is simply not appropriate for this child. Well, we all know once you give a loophole in the law, right, people like to try to drive Mack trucks through it. We don't have any real sense about what these various IEP teams around the country are doing. We don't know if they are, in fact, withholding Braille instruction for, quote-unquote, right reasons, if there are such things. And the reason is because the U.S. Department of Education doesn't monitor appropriately for this. The states aren't held to the requirement or to the expectation that they fess up about what's going on within their states on this subject. And believe me, I mean, Eric and I and a bunch of others have gone to the Department of Education over the course of time and said, you guys need to actually get a little bit more aggressive about this. Look, the blindness community's got some strong language, more strong in some respects than a lot of other communities have for their kids, and yet you guys aren't monitoring this. What's up? What gives? To ask the technical legal question. And the answer that they give is, well, you know what? Yeah, we'd dearly love to help you, but when we monitor for things, we're looking at the big picture stuff, like whether or not kids are in fact being educated in the neighborhood school like the law says they should be. So we've essentially been told, you know what? Sorry, we can't help you. By the U.S. Department of Education and by folks in that world. And so for that and many other reasons, we've said, you know what? We're not going to wait anymore for someone to do kind things for blind and visually impaired students and to make sure that they actually do right by our kids. In fact, what we've said is that, you know what? Since 1975, since the special ed law has been nationally been in place, in that 40-year period of time, thereabouts, we're coming up, and it'll be next year, it'll be the 40th anniversary of that law. We've said, you know, over the course of time, yeah, that law's done some good things. Prior to that period of time, it was really iffy whether or not someone with a kid with a disability would be able to go to the neighborhood school. People would say, you know, I'm sorry, we just can't handle your son or daughter here. We don't have the... No, that's been completely taken off the table. As a matter of right, kids with disabilities have a right to get in the schoolhouse door. What we haven't achieved yet, for a whole host of kiddos with disabilities, but most especially our folks, folks who are deaf or hard of hearing for sure, is that we have not guaranteed that once that kiddo gets in the schoolhouse door, that they're getting the education that they need. And that's why we've worked so hard to develop this thing that Eric was introducing to you, the so-called Alice Cogswell and Ann Sullivan Macy Act. Cogswell was the first deaf girl to be formally educated in the U.S., and of course, Annie Sullivan was Helen Keller's most beloved teacher. And so we thought it was appropriate that this legislation would be named after both a student and a teacher. And in the case of Annie Sullivan, something that a lot of folks forget, and I almost always forget to mention it, I mean, Annie Sullivan was a person with low vision. She graduated, I believe she was valedictorian of the Perkins School for the Blind. What a very cool thing, and so often overlooked by historians, that Helen Keller, we think of her as, you know, okay, this is the person for whom Annie Sullivan performed miracles. Well, you know what? No, it's a case of Annie Sullivan working pretty gosh darn hard, who, by the way, also was a person with a disability. And it's, you know, a good example of our community helping ourselves in a sense. So collectively, we're trying to help ourselves again by trying to push this legislation forward. Now, when Eric and I got this sucker introduced, along with our colleagues in the deafness world, you know, you get the bill introduced and the thing gets assigned a bill number. Sometimes you can ask for Congress to assign a specific bill number for you. You know, some people want to say, well, hey, what about, you know, H.R. 1 or for House Resolution 1 or S. 1? You know, if it wants to be the first thing out of the gate and gets a big bill number, hopefully that means you get a little press out of it. Well, we didn't really do that. We just sort of rolled the dice, so to speak. Here in Vegas, we know something about that. I usually lose when that happens. But the number got assigned to us, and it's H.R. 4040. And so what we've been saying to people, both on the Hill and when we talk about this, is, you know what, for 40 years, we've been waiting for the national special education system to be to do right by our kids, and we're not going to wait another 40. We're not going to wait another 40. So as thank you. So as I've sort of alluded to, the Anne Sullivan Macy Act for us makes a point of saying, you know what, the Braille language that's on the books, it's pretty strong, and by golly, you guys at the federal level and state by state, you're going to do right by our kids by making sure that you fess up about exactly what's happening in your state, because, you know, sunshine has a way of sort of clarifying things, doesn't it? And rather than sort of speculate, well, how many kids are really getting Braille? Who knows? We're going to try to move the agenda forward and strengthen that Braille language so that we can shed a little light on what's going on. And hopefully that means people will take that requirement more seriously. We're going to make sure that orientation and mobility is actually provided to kiddos. I mean, the law is pretty clear that O&M instruction is a service that kids, it's an example of one of the many services that a kid is entitled to if they require special ed and related services. But you'd be amazed, or perhaps no one in this room would be, the number of kids who aren't given orientation and mobility instruction, at least as fully as they should. Same thing is true with low vision devices. The notion that a kid who's got low vision so often seems like a lot of states these days are simply saying, oh, this kid with low vision, you know, he's really kind of borderline in terms of having a disability. And so what we're going to do is we're going to provide some accommodation. You know, if she can sit closer to the board or she can, we'll provide her with some other kind of accommodation. And that's just simply not sufficient. What needs to happen is not only does the special ed system need to get a kid the gizmo that they need, but we also need to make sure that they're properly trained in the use of that gizmo. Because how many times are people provided technology and then they're just left to fend for themselves? And that other issue about the whole array of services that aren't necessarily academic in nature at all, but have to do with a kid being able to live independently on his or her own and be able to navigate a very complex and sometimes cold, cruel world out there and be able to, you know, stand on his or her 2 feet, as it were, and be able to survive. Those kinds of soft skills, you know, some of us would say, I think I've even said this to Eric on occasion. I think we've said it to each other. You know, hey, I had some pretty good parents. And I bet a good number, if not all of you, have had some pretty good parents, too. It's why we're here and doing what we're doing. A lot of parents, for the first time in their lives, you know, when they meet someone who's blind, it's their kid. And they don't know what they're doing with this child. And if the socioeconomic circumstances that that family happens to be in, meaning that the education level of parents is such that they're not necessarily sort of savvy to all what's possible when you get a kid with a significant disability born to your family, they don't know necessarily what to do. I mean, it's easy on the one hand to say, you know what, teaching a blind kid how to make a bed and how to live independently, that should really be the family's responsibility. Well, you know what, it is. On the other hand, we also know that sometimes those parents are just as clueless about expectations of blind kids as everybody else. So what we need to do is to make sure that all of that stuff that I've just been talking about is clearly spelled out in the law, even more than it already is, and then hold states and schools accountable for providing it. In the deafness world, they basically took the legislation that was written, the Anne Sullivan Macy Act, which was draft legislation at the time, and I tell you, they literally, in some cases, took what we wrote and did a find and replace, a search and replace on the phrase blindness and vision impairment and changed it to deafness and hard of hearing. In a lot of cases, because their issues are so parallel. The folks who have sensory disabilities were experiencing a lot of the same things. Obviously, their issues are different in certain respects, but they are parallel, even though some substantively you might think they're different. Good example, interpreter services. And people just sort of make this assumption that a deaf kiddo pops out of the womb knowing how to speak American Sign Language, and that if you, you know, which would be kind of bizarre to see, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be bizarre? Flapping away. Maybe some moms who are wrestling with a kiddo, you know, kicking around in there. Maybe they're signing away. They're doing a soliloquy in there. I don't know. But let's say that kid, you know, they just assume that the kid knows sign language, and so what did the schools do? Oh, deaf kid. Throw an interpreter in there, if they even do that. I mean, that would be a luxury. But that's what they do. They say, this kid will just provide an interpreter, because isn't that what you do with deaf kids? Forgetting entirely that the deaf child needs to be educated in sign language and needs the opportunity to communicate with his or her peers. We're in exactly that same kind of situation. Instead of just dumping a Braille book, if you can even get it, or a gizmo in our laps, kids need instruction in Braille, and they need that whole other set of skills that allow them to live independently. And that's what special education and related services has always been about, and that's what this bill is about. One final point I'll mention is, you know, we named this legislation after arguably two students, but whatever, a student and a teacher. That's entirely appropriate because this bill is all about protecting the rights of kids, but it's also about making sure that we support teachers in the work that they do. So one of the critical things that the Cogswell-Macy bill, as we have come to call it, H.R. 4040, we've waited 40 years, we ain't going to wait another 40. What we've said in that legislation is, you know what, we're going to create something called the Ann Sullivan Macy Center on Visual Disability and Education Excellence. And no, it's not another building someplace, and it's not a replacement for the American Printing House for the Blind, and it's not a money grab for the AFB, even though we certainly need the resources like everybody else in this field does. It's nothing like that. What it is, it's a collaborative effort among organizations, and you bet your bottom dollar that ACB can and should be a part of it. It's a collection of organizations who get together, consumer, professional, and even academic institutions, to do the kinds of things that we haven't done as much of that we need. Research in our field, professional development, sometimes just simply called continuing ed for professionals in our field. Some organizations are doing continuing ed for sure. AFB certainly is. Perkins, you can go down the list of your favorite organization. But they're not. There's nowhere near the level of support that teachers need, especially when she, and it usually is a she, isn't it, when she spends more time in her car getting to and from students than actually providing education to students. And then she does finally get, for the first time in, let's say, 10 years, that kid who is the academic performer and who does need to have all those independent living skills and everything else, but it happens to be a total brainiac and needs exposure to the cool new Braille codes and everything else for math and science. And she's totally baffled because it's been 20 years since she's been in a university program. And if she got Braille instruction at all, it probably isn't necessarily something that she's particularly fluent or conversant in at the moment because she hadn't had the opportunity or the need to use it. And so she needs that kind of support, which this Macy Center can do. So that center idea is something that I think will be very, very useful for a whole host of reasons, and I've sort of outlined a few of them. What can you do? The biggest thing you can do is do whatever the heck Eric Bridges tells you to do. And over the course of this, you know, next year in 2014, I mean, here we are in July, you know, there should be some additional opportunities with every day that goes by. It gets less and less this year, anyhow, but more opportunities to get co-sponsors. He's absolutely right. The idea that we've got 20 people, 20 members of Congress, and it has been on a bipartisan basis, which is great, do need a lot more Republicans to join us, but, you know, the bill is bipartisan. Always has been, always needs to be. So, you know, over the course of this year, hopefully we'll get a Senate bill introduced. The truth is we're going to be living with this issue for a while because the Congress takes up special education in sort of a 3 to 5 year sort of rotation. Now, hopefully this isn't going to be like what happened to us on the Rehab Act where we talked about the Rehabilitation Act for the last 13 years because some of us are going to need a life supply of Pepto-Bismol, I think, if that's the case. Hopefully what's going to happen in the next Congress, right, a Congress meets for every 2 years. The next one's going to sit in January 2015. Over the course of the next 2 years, what we need to do is get this House bill, H.R. 4040, reintroduced. And when we do, hopefully it won't be, you know, H.R. 666. That would be pretty unfortunate. What we need to do is think about a cool new number for it. And then we need to get the Senate bill introduced next year if we can't get it done this year. And then we need to go full tilt on getting you guys to help us to get your member of Congress, your senator, to join on and say, yep, I'm a big supporter of this. Can this legislation ultimately get to a president's desk? Sure, up on its own. Could it conceivably get to President Obama's desk before the end of whatever, his term, January 20th, 2017? Yeah, it's possible. I certainly wouldn't want to bet on it, given my demonstration of betting skills a few moments ago in the casino. But I will just say that, you know, it is conceivable that the legislation could move. Likely what will happen will be that as the Congress takes up special education legislation, as it does periodically, and it's hopefully coming up soon, what we'll have in both the House and the Senate will be champions in both parties who can say, you know what, the last few times over the last 20-some years as the special ed legislation, the special ed law has come up for review, we haven't really spoken up for these communities as much as we should, for the blindness and deafness communities. And I, Senator X, Congressman Y, I am absolutely committed to this. I've heard from my constituents, and they absolutely have said they've had it up to here. They've waited 40 years. They ain't going to wait another 40 for kids to get Braille and the other stuff that they need. And so we are absolutely going to demand leaders in the House, in the Senate, that you guys pay attention to our issues, and they're going to be our champions. So that's likely what's going to happen. So what we're really trying to do is recruit those kind of champions. How do you do that? By building those kind of relationships, and you all know that, and I suppose, Eric, you might probably be talking about this more throughout the rest of today and onward. Biggest thing is when he gives you the heads up, hey, it's time to call, drop an email, stop coming to the legislative seminar in February. Please, please, please respond favorably and do it, because it's only going to be that when you guys do that, pick up the phone, that we make progress. Don't ever let anybody tell you that an individual can't make a difference. It's this isn't some pep talk, whatever, blowing sunshine comment on my part. It genuinely is true that individual people meeting, especially with members of Congress and their senators, even, but especially the staff. You can get a good eager beaver staffer who says, you know what? Yeah, I believe in Braille instruction. I believe in special education. You made a compelling story. And you know what? I also want to look like a hotshot. I mean, the guy that we got to work with us, who was the staffer in Congressman Cartwright's office, Congressman Cartwright from Pennsylvania, I mean, this young man is a go-getter. He wants to go do cool new things, and frankly, he ended up getting another job, not necessarily because of us, but because he's an ambitious young man, and that's great. And what we need to do is find an office, couple of offices like that, whose members are totally committed to our issues and whose staff are totally psyched to help move this agenda forward. If we get that, then we've done, you know, that's 90% of the battle, because then the rest is an awful lot of, I was about to say luck, maybe even prayer, but that's really where the action's at. Thank you so much, and Eric, thanks for the opportunity to address this group.
Cool. Well, we appreciate Mark taking the time to come and chat with us. To his point concerning, co-sponsors and relationships with members of Congress, they're all in your district. I mean, they're going to be back in the states. In fact, there's really only somewhere around 20 legislative days left in the year, where they're going to be actively debating the issues in Washington, which is, frankly, on a personal level, is really poor.
Discouraging.
Yes, it's very discouraging, given the amount of work that they're not doing already. Anyway, but you guys have made a tremendous difference in the sort of the visibility that H.R. 4040 has received. I can directly attribute, of those 20 co-sponsors, 14 of them were persuaded by ACB members from either the legislative seminar or this spring. And that's outstanding. It's good work, but it has to continue. So the same will apply to the low vision device bill that we're going to talk about here in a minute. But there, members of Congress, in particular in the House of Representatives, they're running for their jobs this fall. They're doing town hall meetings. They're doing all kinds of different events to get the word out about, you know, what they've done for you. Odds are one of the things that they haven't done for you yet is co-sponsor this bill or the low vision devices bill. Talk with them, ask them questions, make sure that these issues are put in front of them. Offer up our assistance in the national office, should there be interest, we're ready, willing, and able to do so. I'm nothing more than an email or a phone call away. ebridges@acb.org and 202-467-5081. Absolutely want to help you. But the only way that we can truly do this is if they hear from you all. Because I live in D.C. and they hear and see me and my dog. By the way, the dog's a good entree. But there's only so much that I can do. They need to hear it from their constituents, the people that are voting for them, or in some cases, I suppose, not voting. But irrespective, they need to hear from you. So with that, why don't we transition into the other legislative imperative that we have for this year. And for those of you that were in the CCLVI meeting yesterday, just pretend like you've never heard this before. You all are aware that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services has done an absolutely wonderful job of meeting the needs of blind people through the years. And I believe it was back in 2012 we even honored them with a special recognition, you know, Federal Agency of the Year. They're outstanding in what they do for us. I don't think so. 6 years ago, decided to dust off the eyeglass exclusion from 1965. So don't just go into a coma when I say 1965 and go, oh my God, he's going to talk about history. I don't want to talk about regulations. But in 1965, CMS promulgated this regulation that essentially excluded eyeglasses from being covered under Medicare. In 2008, they said, well, you know, let's revisit this and let's just say anything that has a lens in it, we're not going to cover. What do low vision people use in order to independently get through their day? Use lenses, magnifiers, all kinds of things, right? All kinds of cool little gadgets that I used to use. This is absurd. And it's ridiculous. And it's, you name the word. It's just wrong that they would equate eyeglasses with the devices that we need to use, not to restore our vision, right? But to enhance it, to augment it, to enable us to remain independent, do things privately in our own homes, and remain in our own homes, and not have to rely upon the kindness of friends and family to deal with very personal and sensitive issues oftentimes, right? Whether you're dealing with medication, which, by the way, ACB's done pretty well the last couple of years dealing with this, but that issue is not nowhere near being solved yet. Knowing which pill bottle you got, knowing how much to take, when to take it, what not to take it with, probably alcohol. Then dietary information on boxes of food cans, all of these things. And then, you know, paying the bills. Isn't it awesome when you have your friend come over and you have them help you pay your credit card bill that's got stuff on there from Victoria's Secret and all kinds of other things? So, all of these things, you know, are real. This is our day-to-day life, right? We're out living our lives. We're not heroes and we're not victims. We're just out there doing our thing. And This directly impedes our ability to do that. Why is that? Well, because these devices that we rely on, many of them, are economically burdensome, aren't they? They're expensive. The exhibit hall was filled with a bunch of them. And the challenge that we have is trying to figure out how to be able to take a look at our population, understand our population more. We've got pretty okay numbers to look at in terms of blind, visually impaired people on Medicare, right? But of that population, how many of them actually could benefit from the use of a low vision device were it, you know, ideally to be covered under Medicare? So, after a lot of deliberation, and this is 3 years ago, our president at the time, Mitch Pomeran, said, look, this is an issue that's not going away. It's continuing to fester. We need to try and wrap our arms around this problem and attempt to find some sort of solution, because we were nowhere as a field on attempting to deal with this issue. Sure, we met with CMS and told them, don't do this. This is ridiculous. And we even had some draft legislation that was a legislative priority 1 year that called for for CMS to rescind or vacate the interpretation of the regulation. And that went nowhere. So what were we to do in order to begin to talk about this issue and come up with some a policy structure whereby we could approach Congress and not just get laughed right off the stage, right? So we put together a coalition, of which there were about 20 different agencies for the blind that participated, ranging from National Industries for the Blind. Actually, Tony Stevens, who's in the room, was an active participant. Guide dog schools such as Guiding Eyes, other agencies such as the Seattle Lighthouse, ABVI Goodwill in Rochester, New York, Lighthouse of Central Florida, HumanWare, Independent Living Aids. Interesting array of organizations, right? They all have an interest in this issue from different angles. So got together, talked through the problem and how at least we thought we could best fix it. And the solution that we are proposing, and it is not a final solution, is a 5-year demonstration project. And it's contained within HR 3749. And it has an absurdly long title, which I'm not even going to talk. I'm not even going to say. But it is a 5-year demonstration project that really looks to provide coverage of certain low vision devices for individuals who become eligible and sort of track the progress of that. There's language in the bill that talks about really doing a good national demonstration in order to get a good handle on the numbers of individuals that are benefiting, as well as, frankly, how costly this could be. Because I would submit to you that the reason why they closed the door on us in 2008 is they were probably looking to save some money at our expense. By the way, Mark was talking earlier about the deaf community and how we have many of the same challenges. Are you aware that hearing aids are not covered? There's a lot of people out there that knew that. Wow. It's pretty amazing. So if you... actually, I'm interested in this. How many of you called into the teleseminar that AFB and ACB did in March dealing with this issue? Two? Okay. Where were the rest of you? There were 300 people that called in to this teleseminar on March 12th of this year, to where the subject was the failure of CMS to cover low vision devices and sort of, you know, our piece of legislation as a sort of a beginning point to solve the problem. 300. When you do a teleseminar in the blindness field, it's around 100 folks that show up. And that's sort of a good baseline. I've, in all the years that I've been working in the blindness field and participating on these calls, I have never seen or heard that many. It was scheduled to go 90 minutes. At the end of 90 minutes, there were 18 people still in queue to ask questions. We went an extra half hour. At the end of the 2 hours, right, an extra half hour, there were still 80 people on the call. There is a lot of interest and a lot of passion about this issue out there. The challenge is trying to get folks to talk with their members of Congress about this. I think some of us in the field, in ACB, may be a little bit spooked by the fact that it's a demonstration project, and golly, how do I talk about a demonstration project with my congressman? I'm not well versed in all of this. What you need to do is tell your story. You need to talk about the low vision devices that you use, why they are important to you, how they impact your life, your ability to remain independent and successful as an American citizen, theoretically, and why this legislation is important to you and to the community. No one can tell a story. I can't pretend to tell a story like that. Frankly, I don't even have any usable vision, so I'm probably not the guy. But, all, you know, the vast majority of us in ACB and, frankly, in the blindness community have some level of usable vision. So how do we go about our days? Many, many of us use low vision devices. So let's talk a little bit about how mechanically this could go, this demonstration. So how much money does one need to have in order to get a good, stable, low vision aid that can remain with you as your visual acuity changes? Shout out. Sweet. Okay. Rock and roll. So what we wanted to do as we were drafting this legislation was to, instead of put a ceiling on the device, the cost of the device in terms of a dollar amount, rather institute a floor where devices would be covered that meet a dollar amount, and then have everything above that covered. In theory, right? So in this legislation, the dollar amount is $500 and above. The goal was not to have folks get their magnifiers that you can pick up at Walmart and probably break one every 3 or 4 months and have to go back and that whole show that happens, but rather to be able to start off at a place where the device that would be covered would be something absolutely meaningful to the individual and could remain with the individual for a period of time, in theory. So how does one become eligible to do this? Well, within this legislation, if you're interested in this, you are to see an eye doctor. And essentially what winds up happening is at the end of it, they will recommend and in essence write a prescription for you to be able to do this. So there's not a lot of words on the page when it comes to this bill. And a lot of that is very purposely done, because the negotiations at some point will begin on this, and we want to remain agile in our ability to deal with concerns that, frankly, the doctors may have, that others potentially within the assistive technology industry may have. There are a lot of competing interests that get involved with all of this. And what we're essentially trying to do here is to start a dialogue, right? Not to have the perfect be the enemy of the good. This is another issue, much like the special education legislation. This is probably going to take a little while, right? Given the state of our entitlement programs and the amount of news coverage that they receive for waste, fraud, and abuse and other things, we're going to need to keep at it. But one thing that I know is that we're successful. Ultimately, ACB is very successful, and we've had a string of really outstanding successes over the last 4 or 5 years. We can be successful with this too, no doubt. And what it takes is for you guys to tell your story, to talk with it, to talk with members of Congress about it, to talk inside your own affiliates about this issue and how you want to approach your members of Congress. And remember this, do this for me. Take your devices with you when you meet with these individuals so that they have some understanding and context of what these devices are and how they operate. Cool. A couple of other issues just to raise that I'm sure you all are keenly interested in. One is the Convention on the Rights for Persons with Disabilities, the CRPD, the treaty that won't die. And it is looking like the Senate Foreign Relations Committee may mark up the CRPD next week. There's a bunch of internal negotiations going on right now with the Republicans to see who will be able to support the CRPD. But it's looking like there is movement. Now, it's looked like there could be movement before. And in fact, as you guys probably recall, back in December of 2012, it actually made it to the Senate floor and failed to be ratified, which is really unfortunate and, frankly, a little bit embarrassing. Not just embarrassing for those that voted against it, but that I think the community, the broader disability community, I don't know how you bring something to the floor like that when you don't have the votes. I'll just leave that one hanging out there. So this time around, the disability community, I think, is taking a more reasonable approach, and we'll see what happens. But it does, the indications that I have gotten thus far is that at least within the next week or two, there could very well be a markup. And then after a markup occurs, then it can, assuming that it passes the committee, then it can be readied for floor action for a vote on ratification. And by the way, ratification isn't a simple majority. It's two-thirds. So that was the stumbling block last time. So the last issue is the Workforce Opportunity and Investment Act, also known as commonly known as WIA, but contains the Rehab Act in it, right? And you heard Mark talk about that, and I don't know. We could spend, Michael Byington's in the room. We could talk about the Rehab Act for the next couple hours if you guys want to gather around the old campfire and get some s'mores. But essentially, we spent, for the overwhelming majority of my career in living in Washington and working either at NIB or for a member of Congress or at ACB, I've had to deal with this since 2003, you guys. It's an authorization bill. It's supposed to be reauthorized every 5 years. Yeah, not so much. So what it has done is sort of suck the air out of other employment-related issues for the last decade. And where are we as a community a decade later now with this bill that's going to be signed into law by the president? We're not a lot further. There's nothing revolutionary for blind people in what is known as HR 803. At times over the last decade, there had been versions of this bill that could have done a lot of harm to our community. It could have taken the Rehab Services Administration and put it in a completely different federal agency. Could have moved the Older Blind Program to a completely different federal agency. Could have done this, could have done that. At the end of the day, we're still kind of where we were. So should we be fortunate for that? I don't know. That's an open question. I don't know. We as a community have attempted to influence the process, and for whatever reason, I can take some blame for this, for not being able to be persuasive, but others in the blind community haven't been either. We're not continuing down the path in the way that I think we probably should be. Now, is that to say that we should be angry or bitter or what have you? I don't know that either. So it's just sort of a sort of moment. I feel like I'm stretched out on the couch in a psychiatrist's office a little bit here with you now. But this is sort of where the state of play, as it were, right? A couple of positive things, though, that have happened is, we have an RSA commissioner who's actually very approachable and is interested in our issues. So that's good. And there are others within the Department of Education that are willing to be more, I would say, more fair in hearing ACB's issues. That hasn't always been that way. So there are positive things, at least within the structure of the VOC Rehab program. But in terms of the law, it's like, whatever. So that's where we are. And these are the issues that we're covering. I get the sense that you guys are excited about the special education legislation, as am I. It's cool. It's interesting. It's also going to take a while, as will this low vision device stuff. It, within our community, and I guess I would argue within our lives, things that take a while often are the ones most worth waiting for. And these are two issues that, if done correctly and implemented correctly, could be just absolutely outstanding for our community. So with that, I'm happy to take questions, comments. If you want to vent your spleen, have at it.
Please raise your hand.
Yeah, raise your hand.
I have the microphone here. My questions are about the Medicare provisions. The first is, and I may have not heard this at the beginning, but isn't there litigation that's happened where at least two district courts have declared the Medicare's interpretation of the statute wrong? And if that's true, what are the litigations out there that said they were right?
Oh, okay. Those were, I'm being whispered to by Melanie over here. They were old cases, cases that occurred before the regulation in 2008 went into effect.
Still the same thing. But the regulations in 2008 essentially did the same thing as what the courts held on before.
Right.
Than try and shift the playground.
Indeed. And we, you know, the other thing that I probably didn't talk enough about, although you could argue that I've talked way too much about everything today, is that we went and met with CMS on at least five different occasions over a period of about a year. At the end of the Bush administration, and at the beginning of the Obama administration, to talk with them about these issues, to see if something could be done, if they could be persuaded. And basically they said, go pound sand. Go to Congress. Force us to do this. We met with, you know, the head of CMS once or twice to talk about this. So the challenge in trying to work with them, and I don't know that we really can work with them, is that these aren't political decisions. That this decision was not a political one. This decision was done by career employees. And when that happens, that's very hard to change.
I had a question.
How can we get access to the bills to read the whole thing in entirety so that when we write a letter to our contact, our congressman or our senators, we are not just going on what somebody else said, but we can read it and we can speak directly to the different issues in it so that we make sense when we contact them and we're making a good impression about our knowledge of the bill?
Sure. So we have papers, background papers on both pieces of legislation up on our website on acb.org under advocacy. Under the advocacy link. They were papers that were prepared for our legislative seminar this year. You're more than welcome to go and look at the actual legislative text. I will tell you that the special education bill is, I want to say, 52 pages. So there's a lot there. H.R. 3749, if you Google H.R. 3749, low vision devices, it will pop up. The actual legislative text will be one of the first two or three search results that pop up.
Hi, it's Susan Thompson from Australia. I'm just interested in relation to the education bill. Given that I don't always quite get how the process works in terms of developing legislation here, is it feasible in that kind of a piece of legislation to build in some kind of a user-friendly complaints mechanism so that if a parent with a child at school isn't really getting what the law provides for, that they don't have to take it to the federal court?
Well, you have the right to complain now. Part of the challenge that we face still in this country, unfortunately, is the overall education of the parents and them understanding and knowing their rights when going through the IEP process. And oftentimes, unfortunately, parents are kind of pushed around, and they don't know that they have the ability to complain, to push back. And so that remains a challenge, not just in the blindness community, but in the broader disability community. It remains a challenge.
Here's a question.
Yes.
Thanks. Steve Mendelson, Eric and Melanie, I think that H.R. 3749 uniquely lends itself to grassroots advocacy, and I really applaud the suggestions that people should go talk to their congressional representatives or key congressional staff and bring their low-vision devices with them. But I wonder if we couldn't go further and beyond simply endorsing that, actually organize a grassroots program where we would, I won't say recruit, but identify and thoroughly brief members of our organization who live in the congressional districts, hopefully all 435 of them across the country, and have them go and meet with their representatives in the district office and explain the circumstances, show the devices, explain the consequences ranging from possible unnecessary institutionalization in nursing homes to violation of HIPAA privacy rights and on, and the overall degradation of life that results from the inaccessibility of these. Explain the arbitrariness of CMS, which is something that most Congress members today, given the hatred that exists in Congress for the executive branch, might rapidly and eagerly seize upon, and see if we can get an organized, concentrated, grassroots effort going along those lines to which this legislation, because of its obvious and clear nature and implications, is particularly amenable.
Those are great comments. Thank you. Thanks, Steve. And by the way, thank you for bringing two outstanding resolutions to the Resolutions Committee. I think that we're headed there, Steve. I think that some of this stuff needs to kind of marinate a little bit with folks with regard to the bill and how it impacts their lives. But, you know, having 300 people on a call about something like this, it goes to show that sometimes you can't – I mean, I'm just going to speak on my own behalf. It's astounding to me what people care about and what people don't care about sometimes, okay? And that doesn't mean that one issue should be deemed more important than another, right? But to have 300 people on a call to discuss this issue area was astonishing to me. And so I think that as a community, we're headed in that direction of doing a campaign at some point here in the not-too-distant future. Not too distant future. But frankly, it can start now and should start now with you all. We've got four co-sponsors, guys. Four. That's better than three, but it's not as good as five, and it's sure as heck not as good as 20. So that's my challenge to you. And I am ready, willing, and able, as I said, to assist you guys, your affiliates. I had a really good, or at least what I thought was a good discussion yesterday with CCLVI, and they're interested in playing a role, you know, as a, that's sort of the sweet spot for them, right? This issue. So we'll see how that sort of begins to coalesce in the months to come, too.
I don't see any more hands.
Okay. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming. I know that this is a kind of a strange part of the day and in the middle of the week, and you all have probably been through 15 hours of meetings so far this week. And I appreciate you coming and participating in the legislative seminar. Have a good rest of your convention.